Welcome back, friends and neighbors, to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and today we're going back to another request that was made. Yussi, the listener whose feedback I always take to heart, has requested an episode dealing with organized crime. So Yussi, and everyone else who is curious about the mafiosas, this one's for you. When we talk organized crime, there's really one word, well, really one acronym, which always comes to mind. RICO. RICO, RICO, RICO. If you're listening to this podcast, there's a good chance you've heard of RICO. You probably have a base understanding that RICO affects mobsters and allows prosecutors to convict people. But if you're being really honest with yourself, do you know what RICO is? What it says? What it allows the government to do? Do you know what RICO stands for? Over the next 30 to 40 minutes, you'll find out. Today, we're going to look back at one of the most famous criminals in recent memory, a man who really personified the flashy lifestyle associated with being a leader of an organized crime family. I loved the movie The Godfather, and I've seen Goodfellas more times than I can count. But don't forget, these are Hollywood fictions designed to glamorize lifestyles, which largely need no additional gilding. In the 1980s and early 1990s, many of New York City's industries were completely dominated by organized crime. The Italian Mafia, which is referred to as La Cosa Nostra, or This Thing of Ours in its native tongue, was a loose conglomeration of five powerful criminal syndicates, which called themselves families. The families consisted of the Bonannos, the Lucchesis, the Colombos, the Genoveses, and the Gambinos. Together, these families controlled construction, contracting, dock work, sanitation, and a host of other essential infrastructure commercial enterprises. Our subject today is perhaps the best known of all New York City mobsters, a man who never shied away from the spotlight, whose flashy lifestyle and public persona earned him the nickname the Dapper Don, and whose ability to escape criminal conviction garnered him the moniker the Teflon Don, because the feds could never make charges stick to him. This is the United States versus John Gotti. John Alfonso Gotti Jr., the man we all know as John Gotti, was born October 27th, 1940, in the South Bronx in New York City. Gotti was the fifth of 13 children, born to John Sr. and Philomena Gotti, who went by Fanny, who were both themselves children of Italian immigrants, making Gotti a second-generation American. Gotti traces his grandparents back to Naples, where his parents were married. Of all his siblings, those most relevant to this episode are Eugene, or Gene Gotti, Peter, Richard, and Vincent Gotti. All five would later become part of the Gambino crime family. As a child, Gotti never had any interest in schooling or formal education. By the time he was a teenager, his family had moved from the Bronx to Brooklyn, and Gotti had already become the leader of a local gang in the East New York section of Brooklyn. East New York has always had a reputation for a high crime rate, especially a high violent crime rate. Throughout his life, Gotti always resented the fact that his father, who was an honest day laborer, was unable to provide for his family the way that Gotti felt he should. He harbored feelings of malice toward his father for failing to do what he felt was necessary to provide the life that he determined his family deserved. Gotti had chosen a life of crime by the time he was 12 years old. He would run errands for a mobster named Carmine Fatico, a capo with the Gambino crime family. By 14, he had graduated to attempting to steal a cement mixer from a construction site. During the crime, the mixer fell and crushed several of Gotti's toes, resulting in a slight limp that he had for the rest of his life. Gotti never finished high school. He dropped out when he incorporated his small band of petty criminals into the Gambino crime family. Early in his career as a Gambino foot soldier, he was responsible for mostly petty crimes. He was arrested 9 times between the ages of 18 and 26 on low-level charges, but never served any serious jail time. In 1968, Gotti got his first real taste of a federal prosecution. He was arrested for hijacking a commercial truck, from what was then called Idlewild Airport, which we now know as JFK Airport in Queens, New York. It's around this time that Gotti met his mentor, Gambino underboss Agnello Della Croce, who went by Neil. I recognize that not everyone here has represented organized crime members, and consequently is less than familiar with the very intricate hierarchies of the organized crime families. So let's have a brief crash course in how one would progress through the ranks of an organized crime family in New York City from the time of its establishment by Salvatore Maranzano in 1931. We'll start at the ground and work our way up. This is something that Hollywood will typically maintain a good degree of accuracy on. When a person enters into the lowest level of an organized crime family, they become an associate. An associate isn't a member of the mafia itself, and there's no ethnic or nationality requirements. However, they carry out business on behalf of the family and are considered tangential, though not direct members. Non-Italians can never progress farther than this, regardless of how influential they become. Famous mobsters Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, and Mickey Cohen were given significant respect and wide latitude, but were only considered associates within their crime families. Once an associate has proven himself worthy of induction into the family, he becomes a made man, and it's called a soldier. From this point on, only a person of full Italian heritage can progress. Soldiers are the main workers of the family, and in most cases are able to issue orders to associates. Once a member is made, i.e. becomes a soldier, he becomes untouchable. The boss of the soldier's family himself must give permission for the man to be killed. Any made man may recommend an associate be made into a soldier, but there is a very serious vetting process. Soldiers are responsible for the majority of the crimes we associate with the mafia: the assaults, extortions, murders, intimidation, protection, racket collections, that kind of thing. Now, a soldier is part of a specific crew, which reports to a capo. A capo's crew usually has between 10 and 15, maybe 20 soldiers under the capo's command. Capos are directly appointed by the boss of the family. The capo is responsible for certain monetary obligations to the family and for making sure that the tasks that the crew is assigned are actually carried out. If the crew fails to produce enough money or does not accomplish a goal, it's the capo that takes the heat. Above the line of capos is the underboss. This is a singular position. One person acts as the family underboss. He is the number two of the family and is typically seen as the projected successor to the family should the boss be killed or imprisoned. The underboss runs the day-to-day operations of the entire family. He reports only to the boss, and his word is to be obeyed by any capo, soldier, or associate without question. The head of the family is, of course, the boss. He's referred to as the Don, or the godfather of the family. He is responsible for the overall operations of the family, and his word is law. In some situations, when there is a power vacuum, let's say both the boss and underboss were arrested or assassinated together, the next boss may be chosen by a vote of the capos of the family. Now, Paul, I hear you saying, I saw the godfather, and I know there's another position. Tom Hagen was consigliere to the godfather, and he was Irish, not Italian. So here's how this works in the real world. Consigliere is a real position. He could basically be considered part of the trinity of command, but in actuality, he works as a personal advisor to the Don rather than somebody who has direct reports. His role is essential because he's the person trusted to voice a counter opinion to the Don. He's the only person who is allowed to directly question a plan or give pushback. He's viewed as a disinterested voice of reason for the good of the family, always. Because of this, the consigliere is typically someone who the Don has known his entire life, or at least most of it, who holds his implicit trust. And make no mistake, this person will be a full-blooded Italian. Sometimes they may rise through the ranks from being a soldier to a capo. Sometimes they may come from the outside. Again, in The Godfather, they portrayed Tom Hagen as the family lawyer. That's mostly metaphor, as the consigliere is an advisor and counselor. It's not a legal or a law-related position. Okay, that was a bit of a long diatribe, but I think that it's important for you to understand the hierarchy to really understand the rise of John Gotti. Remember, Gotti starts out as an associate. Before we explored this minor rabbit hole, we were talking about how Gotti had met his mentor, Neil Della Croce, and had been arrested in 1968 by the FBI for hijacking a truck from what's now JFK Airport. Within the span of a few short months, Gotti had been arrested for forging signatures for stolen merchandise from United Airlines, stealing the previously mentioned truck, and then hijacking another truck of cigarettes on the New Jersey Turnpike. He pled guilty and served 3 years. He was paroled in 1972, and this is his first real run-in with federal law enforcement. Unfortunately, we really don't have time to go through all the factual background surrounding Gotti's rise through the ranks, so I'm going to give you some of the highlights so that you have a basic understanding of his prolific trajectory. I'm not getting too bogged down in historical details, as much as I would love to. This is, after all, preliminarily a podcast about trials, not about background facts. And anybody who's interested in the life of John Gotti can pick up any number of books or biographies written about him if you want more biographical information. So when Gotti was paroled, he was still an associate. He was not a made man yet. Normally, he would have been inducted to soldier level from being an associate, but he'd become so close with the capo Carmine Fatico from his youth that when Fatico was arrested, he named Gotti to be acting capo in his place. Gotti started reporting directly to his mentor, underboss Neil Della Croce. In 1976, Carlo Gambino, who was Don at the time, passed away. But he appointed his brother-in-law, Paul Castellano, to succeed him as Don, instead of the expected underboss, Della Croce. This caused a massive split within the family. The following year, 1977, recruitment ended a year-long hiatus, and Gotti was inducted and became a made man. He became the capo of Fatico's crew, rather than just acting capo. Now, Gotti didn't respect or like Paul Castellano. He was, however, rising in stature in the Gambino family due to his affinity for sending messages through violence and his larger-than-life persona. Castellano was arrested in 1984 on a RICO charge and is facing life. He appoints Gotti as acting boss alongside Thomas Bellotti and Thomas Gambino. Three of them were to share the role. Gotti formed a commission called the FIST, consisting of, among others, Salvatore Gravano, who goes by Sammy, and Joseph Armone. Gravano was a brutish, violent trigger man, and Armone was an old-timer who commanded significant family respect. Gotti was convinced that Castellano meant to have him killed as a rival. Paul Castellano was then gunned down in front of Sparks Steakhouse in Manhattan, New York, on December 16, 1985, while he was still under indictment. Now, obviously, there were a lot of intra-family dynamics that we've kind of glossed over to get to the important aspects, and I apologize for that, but unfortunately, we don't have time to go through all of it. Gotti and Gravano were nearby and drove by the scene afterwards to ensure that Castellano was dead. Legend has it that after Castellano's death, it was an open secret that Gotti had organized it. And there ensued a meeting of the capos, where they were all relieved of any weapons. And then they were surrounded by Gotti's men while they voted for the new boss of the family. And lo and behold, Gotti won the vote. So in 1986, Gotti has become the godfather of the Gambino crime family. At the time, the Gambino crime family was the most powerful and influential of the five families, with an annual estimated income of around $500 million. Gotti was enjoying the limelight. He wore flashy suits. He was a romanticized criminal figure in the style of Al Capone himself. The media referred to him as the Dapper Don, and he ate up every minute of it. This, naturally, was a major irritant to the Department of Justice, who long had dreams of taking down the mob. A series of federal prosecutions had then failed to convict Gotti of anything, leading to his new nickname, the Teflon Don, because the feds were never able to make charges stick to him. The feds were hardly to blame. The United States Attorney's Office didn't lose these cases because of incompetence or a lack of evidence. Several key jurors were paid handsomely for directing verdicts in favor of Gotti. Again, a few different arrests on both the state and federal level, nothing sticks. Then on December 11th, 1990, Gotti is arrested again. Federal agents had bugged the Ravenite Club, where he conducted business, and several key residences where Gotti had felt that he could speak freely. Gotti's charged with racketeering, extortion, jury tampering, and other crimes. Now, this brings us to our first legal intricacy. When Gotti was arrested, he had initially planned to hire his top-shelf legal team of Bruce Cutler and Jerry Chargell, who had orchestrated his string of acquittals in the past. In the 1980s and 90s, Cutler and Chargell were known to be the top lawyers for organized crime members in New York City, bar none. It was those two. The Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution provides for an accused to have the right to counsel, and denying a defendant a lawyer is immediate grounds for overturning a conviction. But the rule is that you are guaranteed a lawyer, not necessarily any lawyer you want. It's easy to see why we don't force expensive top-end lawyers to take cases for free because a defendant decides that's the attorney that he wants but he can't pay for. Forcing someone, even a lawyer, to work for free is indentured servitude. We do, however, encourage lawyers to voluntarily work pro bono, meaning for free, and in that way, some expensive lawyers may choose to take on clients who cannot afford them. But this situation was obviously different. Money was not the obstruction here. Prosecutors filed a motion before the Honorable Judge Leo Glasser, claiming that Cutler and Chargell had worked as in-house counsel for the Gambino organization. They had been captured on some of the tapes, and though not charged with any crimes themselves, could potentially be called as witnesses during the trial, and therefore could not be lawyers representing any of the defendants. Judge Glasser agreed, and Gotti was precluded from hiring his legal dream team. So he instead hires Albert Krieger, a Miami-based lawyer who had represented the Don of the Bonanno family previously. In 1990, the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of New York was Andrew Maloney. Maloney, in the Eastern District, was not Rudy Giuliani, who was the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District in the 1980s. While Giuliani had a reputation for being a somber and severe prosecutor, Maloney came across as affable and friendly. He wasn't the greatest legal scholar in his own office, but he was a thoughtful and sensible man who knew how to correct mistakes. Gotti and his compatriots were charged first and foremost with RICO. If you know anything about organized crime prosecutions in New York City, you have heard those four letters before. But what is RICO? Where did it come from? What does it allow prosecutors to do? RICO stands for Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations. It's part of the Organized Crime Control Act of 1970 and was enacted in direct response to the Mafia, signed into law by President Nixon. What was new about RICO was that it expanded on the existing law about criminal conspiracy in ways that significantly extend liability. RICO made it a criminal defense to be employed by or associated with a criminal enterprise. An enterprise is defined as including any individual, partnership, corporation, association, or other legal entity, and any union or group of individuals associated in fact, although not a legal entity. So in order to prove a RICO charge in a court of law, the prosecutor is required to establish five elements beyond a reasonable doubt. 1. That an enterprise existed. 2. That the enterprise affected interstate commerce. 3. That the defendant was associated with or employed by the enterprise. 4. That the defendant engaged in a pattern of racketeering activity. Or five, that the defendant conducted or participated in the conduct of the enterprise through the pattern of racketeering activity through the commission of at least two racketeering acts as set forth in the indictment. So what exactly does this mean in layman's terms? Historically, the feds would pick up some low-level guys for extortion, or arson, or assault, or any number of racketeering offenses. Those individuals would be prosecuted, and as soon as they were convicted, either by plea or by trial, other associates or soldiers would move into their positions, and the organizations would continue without missing a beat. Because until RICO, prosecutors could not characterize the entire organization as criminal. It's difficult to really understand now, 50 years later, but this was a real sea change in organized crime prosecutions, because now prosecutors could designate the organization itself as criminal and go after it, rather than simply going after the individual members for their low-level individual acts. Let's compare this with conspiracy so you can kind of get a full understanding of the difference here. In a conspiracy prosecution, the government is looking to establish that two or more people entered into an agreement to engage in some criminal act, and that they took at least one overt act in order to achieve that criminal goal. The problem that prosecutors would run into is that these complex criminal organizations had literally hundreds, if not thousands, of individual conspiracies. There were conspiracies to commit murder, conspiracies to commit arson, conspiracies to commit usury, bribery, assaults, any number of individual crimes. But you had to be able to prove that this specific defendant was a specific member of that specific conspiracy in order to prosecute him. If you could prove that a defendant was a member of 99 conspiracies, but not the particular one which was the subject of your trial, your defendant was walking free. In a RICO prosecution, the employment or association with the criminal enterprise is the conspiracy. Under RICO, lower-level associates and soldiers are, first and foremost, looking at a 20-year sentence or more if they're convicted of RICO, even if the underlying offenses wouldn't come anywhere near those penalties. So this naturally encouraged small fish to cooperate against bigger fish. But it also made it far easier to tie the conspiracies together in order to prosecute individuals who could be put into the RICO organization. Let's take a quick example to showcase how RICO works. Let's say that John is a down-on-his-luck college grad with dreams of becoming a hand surgeon, but who experienced a string of bad luck and is now broke and he has a family. He falls in with the Gambinos and works as an associate since he's not Italian. John's an athletic, scrappy guy, and the word comes down to him from the local capo that a bank in his district isn't paying protection money. John is asked to go rough up the bank manager. John breaks the bank manager's legs, and the manager pays to the family what they claim he owes. The following month, John gets a similar order regarding a gas station owner. Again, he breaks the man's legs, and the man remits the money to the Gambinos. Before RICO, John is liable for two separate assault charges on the state level. Now, John has no record. There's nothing available to tie other people in, so John maybe does a little time. His family gets a little compensation from the Gambinos while he's in jail, and then he's out soon and back to work, breaking legs. Chances are, at most, he's doing a fairly short jail stint. Now, the same scenario with RICO. John is picked up by the FBI instead of local cops. He's committed two predicate racketeering acts on behalf of a criminal enterprise, which financially benefited from his behavior. Prosecutor tells John he's looking at 20 years for RICO, plus fines of up to three times the amount of money he obtained for the organization. Suddenly, John might start to think about cooperating and telling the feds who instructed him to carry out the leg breaking. So that's the first part of RICO, which deals with soldiers and lower-level guys. Now let's talk about how RICO was really intended to dismantle organized crime. The second part of RICO is tailored specifically to the bosses. There's a specific provision in the RICO statute which makes it unlawful for any person, through a pattern of racketeering activity, to acquire control of a criminal enterprise. Put another way, a mafia don or godfather was criminally liable for being a don or godfather, even if there was no proof ever produced that he committed a particular legal act, if the prosecutor could show that he was in control of the criminal enterprise and he rose through the ranks through a pattern of racketeering, he could be convicted of RICO. Now, of course, having to show that he engaged in a pattern of racketeering does require some evidence of illegal activity, but it didn't necessarily have to relate to the case that they were prosecuting against lower-level crime members. Okay, so let's bring this back to Gotti. The question for Maloney and the Eastern District prosecutors is, How do you prove that Gotti is in charge of the enterprise and that he rose through the ranks through a pattern of racketeering? Proving the Gambino crime family is a criminal organization was not very difficult, but proving that Gotti is in charge of it would require actual evidence. In the 1990s, it was all about eavesdropping surveillance, or bugging. The feds placed bugs all over, and they captured conversations where Gotti bragged about people he had ordered murdered, and his discontent with murders which he felt were taking too long to be carried out. Now, Gotti faced 13 counts, which included responsibility for orchestrating 5 murders, including the Castellano and Bellotti murders in front of the Sparks Steakhouse. The other counts were related to other racketeering activities. Those of you intimately familiar with New York City geography will know that Sparks Steakhouse is in Manhattan, which would fall into the Southern District of New York, while Gotti and his co-defendants were charged in the Eastern District of New York. So, is there a jurisdiction issue here? And the answer is no. The requirement is that something take place in the Eastern District of New York in order to bring the case there. There is no requirement that all criminal activities, or even the bulk of criminal activities, take place in the district which is bringing the case. So the fact that some of the racketeering activity charged took place in the Eastern District was enough to prosecute them there, even though the big flashy murder, which was the centerpiece of the prosecution, took place in Manhattan. Naturally, this case made national headlines. It was all people were talking about when Gotti was arrested. Big reason for this was that Gotti was the most high-profile mobster left. In the mid-80s, Rudy Giuliani had made it his life's work while U.S. Attorney at the Southern District to root out organized crime, and he prosecuted the heads of the 5 families. Remember that Paul Castellano himself was under indictment by Giuliani when Gotti had him killed and took control. The result was that several of the dons of the big families received life sentences as Giuliani secured massive RICO convictions. While the other families were attempting to rebuild, Gotti personified the strength of the Gambino house. Now, in the past, we discussed several times the difference between what everybody knows and what you can prove in a court of law beyond a reasonable doubt. It was no secret that John Gotti was the boss of the Gambino crime family. That was widely known. But there's a very serious code among made men concerning what happened to cooperators. They were labeled as rats, snitches. And it wasn't that they were just blacklisted from union work or kept out of lucrative government contracts afterwards. Everyone knew if you turned state's evidence, the mafia would find you and would kill you. Loyalty was the most important character trait that a made man could have. So here's my thought on the how and why this case took the dramatic turn it did, and how John Gotti was convicted of all 13 counts. I'm going to assume a lot of people know what took place at the trial, but for the sake of perhaps either the international listeners or those who aren't as steeped in organized crime as the rest of us, I'm not going to give any spoilers here. Now, this is just my opinion. But I think that loyalty was only beat into every made man, more or less, in a one-way street. As an Italian mafioso, you swore unyielding loyalty to the family. But I think that those members, especially those who rose through the ranks, expected to be shown that same loyalty back from the family. I think that everyone, from soldier up to underboss, expected that the other members of the family would not sell them out, just as they wouldn't sell out the family. And I think that finding out that someone, especially the boss of the family, was speaking ill of you, even if not to law enforcement itself, would have been considered a capital betrayal. Prosecutors knew that in order to prove that Gotti had employed racketeering tactics to acquire control of a criminal enterprise, they would need to have recorded conversations of him talking about it. They knew they were never going to turn anyone high enough to prove firsthand accounts of Gotti's activities without significant pressure, and breaking that loyalty to the family was next to impossible. So they sifted through the hundreds of hours of bugged conversations, and then they hit gold. Tucked into the recordings were conversations that Gotti had where he stated that Sammy Gravano, who he had just appointed as his underboss, his number two, his second in command, was becoming too greedy. And he claimed that Gravano was the main driving force behind the murders of Robert DiBernardo, Liborio Milito, and Luis De Bono. Three murders that were unrelated to the Sparks Steakhouse shooting, but which were charged in the indictment. Now, of course, at the time of these conversations, Gotti didn't know that he would be indicted for these three murders. He was just spouting off with his close associates and advisors. But after Gotti and Gravano were arrested and charged together, Gravano was given access to the tapes. Now, again, keep in mind, this is just my thought, and I can't verify if it's true or not. But I think that Gravano's worldview was shattered when he heard that his best friend, the only person that outranked him in the family at this point, slandered him. That type of disloyalty was unheard of. Now, as boss, Scotty could say anything he wanted about anyone. But Gravano would have believed that he and Gotti were brothers forever, and neither would ever have a negative thing to say about the other. It's also very possible that Gravano became concerned that Gotti's defense strategy was going to be to try to pin every murder on Gravano himself, another thing which mafia members never did. If accused, a made man never pointed a finger at another made man. So Gravano did what was considered beyond comprehension at the time. He cooperated with the government. This revelation was earth-shattering in the organized crime world. Nobody turned state's evidence, and for an underboss to do it was more than most family members could believe. Jury selection for the trial began in January 1992. Maloney had tapped veteran John Gleason to head the prosecution trial team. Now, Maloney had a vivid recollection of how the previous trials had ended, so he requested that Judge Glasser employ an anonymous jury to ensure that no tampering or intimidation occur. And Judge Glasser agreed. Instead of names, jurors were known only by number and general occupation. No identifying information about them was kept. They were also discharged from the trial every day in secret so that they would not be followed. Krieger's defense employed a similar strategy to what was successfully employed by Bruce Cutler and Jerry Chargell previously. They painted the prosecutors as overzealous, reaching out to make a case out of nothing because they simply didn't like Gotti. They claimed that each of the government's witnesses would say anything to get a lesser sentence, and were lying because they knew how badly the U.S. Attorney's Office wanted evidence regarding Gotti. Considering the litany of immoral and unlawful acts the government's witnesses had committed, it wasn't a bad strategy. But Gleason was ready for this. Right from the opening statements, he began playing the tapes. And his theme, his narrative that he stuck through, was that the jury didn't need to believe his cooperators. The jury could believe Gotti's own words right from his own mouth about how he was running the family via the tapes. And the icing on the cake for Gleason was Gravano's testimony. He was on the stand for a full 9 days. He admitted to taking part in 19 murders, 10 of which were at the direct order of Gotti, including Castellano. Never in the history of organized crime prosecutions had such a high-ranking member of a family agreed to testify and provide such a full and clear picture of the hierarchy, the administration, the decision-making apparatus, and the utter ruthlessness and violence of a mafia family. It truly sealed Gotti's fate. The trial lasted 7.5 weeks. And after all that, the jury deliberated only 14 hours before convicting John Gotti on all 13 counts. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, died in Marion, Illinois, at the federal penitentiary there, at the age of 61 from cancer. For his part, Gravano confessed to 19 murders and many other acts of racketeering. He was sentenced to 5 years. 5 years. Let that sink in. 5 years is 60 months. It's a little more than 3 months per murder. It should come as no surprise that a lot of people took issue with that. In summation, RICO is an incredibly powerful tool. And that's what it truly is, a tool. Sometimes tools are used for their appropriate purposes, but a tool can be used for things it was never envisioned for. Anytime you give a prosecutor a tool, they're going to look for any and all applications they can use it for. That's natural, and it's not necessarily wrong. Criminals are always evolving, coming up with new ways to beat the system. So prosecutors must always be adapting and figuring out novel ways to use the tools they have. Think of Al Capone being prosecuted for tax evasion. The problem is that sometimes legislators don't take into account the various ways their tools can be used, and then the tools end up being abused. Under RICO, the acts of one person can make any organization deemed a criminal enterprise. Literally, a salesman for Walmart could employ intimidation to force certain vendors to accept contracts which are unfairly beneficial to Walmart. If he does this twice in a period of 10 years, Walmart, as a whole, could be deemed a criminal enterprise because his actions benefited Walmart. That doesn't mean the CEO and chairman of the board are going to get arrested, but it does mean that Walmart as a company could face criminal prosecution and sky-high fines because of the actions of a single rogue salesman. Now, that's just one example of how RICO can go overboard. As a society, we trust prosecutors not to go overboard. But history is filled with examples of people zealously pursuing any available avenue for a conviction. In general, people are wary of prosecutors because there's always a sense of apprehension that they'll pursue a conviction at all cost instead of justice, which on some occasions doesn't mean a guilty verdict. In the end, there's no question that the advent of RICO has weakened the mafia. It still does employ some power in key New York City industries, but it in no way exhibits the influence it did in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and early 90s. The families very much still exist and still adhere to their code, but it's much easier now to go after the leadership, which has reduced their reach significantly. So that's the episode on John Gotti and organized crime. I hope you're coming out of this with a better understanding of RICO and organized crime prosecutions. While I was researching and writing this episode, I actually did get a question about whether or not I've ever represented organized crime members. And the answer is yes, but I don't discuss my own cases on the show, especially if I don't have permission from my client to do so, which I do not. So all I will say is that I have represented a fairly high member of the Lucchese family, and that's it. A special thank you to Dan Townsend, my audio engineer, and to Yossi for requesting a show on organized crime. I really hope you enjoyed it. As I've stated, I will do my best to get to any listener requests. If you want to email me requests or questions about this or any other episodes, you can reach me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. That's all for the show. Thanks so much for stopping by, and I sincerely hope that you'll come back for more.